Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Punished by Rewards, The Trouble with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, A's, Praise, and Other Bribes, by Alfie Cohn. Narrated by Alfie Cohn.
Preface. I came very close to failing Introduction to Psychology. This was at a school, you should understand, where the word psychology meant the experimental study of animal physiology and behavior, and the only thing we students were required to do, apart from sitting through lectures, was to train caged rats to press a little bar. We reinforced them with Rice Krispies for doing this, and since they had been starved to 80% of normal body weight, they would have done almost anything for a little cereal. I was successful, then, in carrying out the assignment, but less successful in figuring out the reason I was doing it. In a rather sophomoric act of rebellion, which was only appropriate given that I was in my second year of college at the time, I turned in a lab report written from the rat's point of view. The report described how, merely by pressing a bar, it had trained a college student to engage in breakfast-feeding behavior. The instructor was not amused, and as I say, I barely passed the course. But that didn't stop me from immediately writing a parody of a psychology journal article for the school paper. I had the article's author claiming a 100% success rate in conditioning his rats to avoid pressing lever B, which caused a 300-pound anvil to drop suddenly from the top of the cage, proudly noting that not a single rat had touched that lever more than once. In retrospect, I think it can fairly be said that I did not take well to behaviorism when first introduced to it, nor did it grow on me as the years went by. By the time I had moved to Cambridge, home of B.F. Skinner, I decided it was time to ask him some of the questions that I had furiously scrawled in my copies of his books. I invited him to come speak to a class I was teaching, and to my surprise, he agreed, and even gamely smiled for the instamatics held by awed students. A few months later, I hit on the idea of writing a profile of Professor Skinner for a magazine, which gave me the opportunity to interview him twice more. In these sessions, he patiently answered all my questions. I found myself admiring the fact that while his age had dulled his eyesight and hearing, it had not muted his evangelical fervor for behaviorism. Eventually, I recovered from my preoccupation with Skinner's ideas, but then only to become increasingly concerned about the popular version of behaviorism, whereby we try to solve problems by offering people a goodie if they do what we want. When, for example, I began to discover in my researches an extensive collection of evidence demonstrating that competition holds us back from doing our best work, it soon became clear that one of the reasons for its surprising failure is its status as an extrinsic motivator, a Rice Krispie, if you will. Later, investigating the question of altruism, I found studies showing that rewarding children for their generosity is a spectacularly unsuccessful way of promoting that quality. Gradually, it began to dawn on me that our society is caught in a whopping paradox. We complain loudly about such things as the sagging productivity of our workplaces, the crisis of our schools, and the warped values of our children. But the very strategy we use to solve those problems, dangling rewards like incentive plans and grades and candy bars in front of people, is partly responsible for the fix we're in. We are a society of loyal Skinnerians, unable to think our way out of the box we have reinforced ourselves into. I headed back to the libraries and found scores of studies documenting the failure of pop behaviorism, studies whose existence remains unknown to all but a few social psychologists. No wonder there had never been a book written for a general audience that showed how rewards undermine our efforts to teach students, or manage workers, or raise children, much less a broader critique that looked at all three arenas. This is what I set out to write, well aware that such a challenge to conventional thinking would be even more unsettling than a lab report written from the rat's perspective. Of this book's 12 chapters, the first six lay out the central argument. Chapter 1 briefly reviews the behaviorist tradition, the prevalence of pop behaviorism in our society, and some reasons for its widespread acceptance. Chapter 2 weighs arguments about the intrinsic desirability of rewarding people, first challenging the claim that doing so is morally or logically required, and then proposing that there is actually something objectionable about the practice. Chapter 3 moves from philosophical arguments to practical consequences, summarizing the research evidence showing that rewards simply do not work to promote lasting behavior change or to enhance performance. In fact, they often make things worse. Then, in chapters 4 and 5, I explain why this is true, offering five key reasons for the failure of rewards, all of which amount to serious criticisms of the practice, apart from their effects on performance. Chapter 6 examines one particular reward that few of us would ever think to criticize, praise. The second half of the book examines the effect of rewards, and alternatives to them, with respect to the three issues I've mentioned: employees' performance, students' learning, and children's behavior. This part of the book is arranged so that listeners primarily interested in only one of these topics won't have to wade through discussions of the other two. Workplace issues are discussed in chapters 7 and 10, educational issues in chapters 8 and 11, and the question of children's behavior and values, which is relevant to teachers as well as parents, in chapters 9 and 12. Part 1. The Case Against Rewards. Chapter 1. Skinner Boxed: The Legacy of Behaviorism. For the anthropomorphic view of the rat, American psychology substituted a ratomorphic view of man. Arthur Koestler, The Act of Creation. There is a time to admire the grace and persuasive power of an influential idea, and there is a time to fear its hold over us. The time to worry is when the idea is so widely shared that we no longer even notice it, when it is so deeply rooted that it feels to us like plain common sense. At the point when objections are not answered anymore because they are no longer even raised, we are not in control. We do not have the idea. It has us. This book is about an idea that has attained just such a status in our society. The idea is that the best way to get something done is to provide a reward to people when they act the way we want them to. Scholars have debated the meaning and traced the development of the intellectual tradition known as behaviorism. What interests me, though, is the popular or pop incarnation of this doctrine, the version that lives in our collective consciousness and affects what we do every day. The core of pop behaviorism is, do this and you'll get that. The wisdom of this technique is very rarely held up for inspection. All that is open to question is what exactly people will receive and under what circumstances it will be promised and delivered. We take for granted that this is the logical way to raise children, teach students, and manage employees. We promise bubblegum to a 5-year-old if he keeps quiet in the supermarket. We dangle an A before a teenager to get her to study harder. We hold out the possibility of a Hawaiian vacation for a salesman who sells enough of the company's product. It will not take more than a few paragraphs to make the case that we are deeply committed to this way of thinking and behaving. But my aim is considerably more ambitious. I want to argue that there is something profoundly wrong-headed about this doctrine, that its assumptions are misleading, and the practices it generates are both intrinsically objectionable and counterproductive. This last contention in particular, that from a purely pragmatic point of view, pop behaviorism usually fails to produce the consequences we intended, takes up most of this book. To offer such an indictment is not to suggest that there is something wrong with most of the things that are used as rewards. It's not bubble gum itself that's the problem, nor money, nor love and attention. The rewards themselves are in some cases innocuous, and in other cases indispensable. What concerns me is the practice of using these things as rewards. To take what people want or need and offer it on a contingent basis in order to control how they act, this is where the trouble lies. Our attention is properly focused, in other words, not on that, the thing desired, but on the requirement that one must do this in order to get that. My premise here is that rewarding people for their compliance is not the way the world works, as many insist. It is not a fundamental law of human nature. It is but one way of thinking and speaking, of organizing our experience and dealing with others. It may seem natural to us, but it actually reflects a particular ideology that can be questioned. I believe that it is long past time for us to do so. The steep price we pay for our uncritical allegiance to the use of rewards is what makes this story not only intriguing, but also deeply disconcerting. Pigeons and rodents and dogs. Rewards were in use long before a theory was devised to explain and systematize their practice. John B. Watson suggested that behaviorism, of which he is known as the father, began with a series of lectures he gave at Columbia University in 1912. But a summary statement very similar to "do this and you'll get that," the so-called law of effect, which states that behavior leading to a positive consequence will be repeated, was set out by psychologist Edward Thorndike back in 1898. What's more, 1 year before Watson's lectures, Frederick W. Taylor published his famous book, The Principles of Scientific Management, which described how tasks at a factory should be broken into parts, each assigned to a worker according to a precise plan, with financial rewards meted out to encourage maximum efficiency in production. A full century earlier, a system developed in England for managing the behavior of school children assigned some students to monitor others and distributed tickets, redeemable for toys, to those who did what they were supposed to do. This plan, similar to what would later be called a token economy program of behavior modification, was adopted by the first public school in New York City in the early years of the 19th century. It was eventually abandoned because, in the view of the school's trustees, the use of rewards, quote, fostered a mercenary spirit and engendered strifes and jealousies. For as long as animals have been domesticated, people have been using rudimentary incentive plans to train their pets. In short, pop behaviorism might be said to predate and underlie behaviorism proper, rather than the other way around. But a few words about the more academic version and the remarkable beliefs of its founders will help us understand just what is involved when rewards are offered in everyday life. Survivors of introductory psychology courses will recall that there are two major varieties of learning theory: classical conditioning, identified with Pavlov's dogs, and operant or instrumental conditioning, identified with Skinner's rats. Classical conditioning begins with the observation that some things produce natural responses. Rover salivates when he smells meat. By pairing an artificial stimulus with a natural one, say, ringing a bell when the steak appears, Rover comes to associate the two. Voila! A response has been conditioned. The bell alone is now sufficient to elicit dog drool. Operant conditioning, by contrast, is concerned with how an action may be controlled by a stimulus that comes after it rather than before it. When a reward, Skinner preferred the term reinforcement, follows a behavior, that behavior is likely to be repeated. A good deal of research has refined and embellished this straightforward principle, focusing on such issues as how to time these rewards for best effect. But Skinnerian theory basically codifies and bestows solemn scientific names on something familiar to all of us. Do this and you'll get that will lead an organism to do this again. Virtually everyone who has thought about the matter agrees that both of these principles are useful for describing how some learning takes place. There's no shortage of familiar examples to flesh out the concepts. Anyone who has ever heard a toilet flush while taking a shower and immediately jumped backward provides a living illustration of how one stimulus, a flushing sound, can come to be associated with another, scalding water. Anyone who has ever watched a child settle down in a hurry when promised a treat for doing so knows that rewards can affect behavior. This book is more concerned with the second sort of learning, operant conditioning. To begin with, though, it focuses on a set of beliefs about this phenomenon, and by implication, about human beings. Skinnerians are not only interested in figuring out how rewards work, they are apt to argue that virtually everything we do, indeed who we are, can be explained in terms of the principle of reinforcement. This is the essence of behaviorism, and it is the point of departure for our investigation. B.F. Skinner could be described as a man who conducted most of his experiments on rodents and pigeons and wrote most of his books about people. This fact did not give him pause because people, to him, were different from other species only in the degree of their sophistication. As a behaviorist sees it, you are more complex than a pigeon, in large part because you have vocal cords, but the theory of learning that explains how a bird trapped in a laboratory apparatus called a Skinner box comes to peck repeatedly at a disc also suffices to explain how you and I come to understand symbolism. Man is an animal different from other animals only in the types of behavior he displays, Watson announced on the very first page of Behaviorism, the book that convinced Skinner to become a psychologist. Thus it is that behaviorists speak sweepingly of how organisms learn. For most of us, the existence of uniquely human capacities would raise serious questions about this theory. But Boris Frederick Skinner, who died in 1990 at the age of 86, was not most people. One of the first things you realize when reading his books is that it is hard to offer an unfair caricature of the man's views. It is also difficult to use the technique of reductio ad absurdum in challenging them. Critics have exclaimed, "But if that's true, then here's the obviously ludicrous conclusion that follows." And instead of backpedaling and becoming flustered, Skinner would nod and cheerfully say, "Right you are." For example, he insisted that organisms, including us, remember, are nothing more than repertoires of behaviors. And these behaviors can be fully explained by outside forces he called environmental contingencies. A person is not an originating agent. He is a locus, a point at which many genetic and environmental conditions come together in a joint effect. But this would seem to imply that there is no self, as we usually use the term, would it not? Yes, indeed, replied Skinner. But surely Fred Skinner the man, not the scientist, but the fellow who ate his breakfast and told a good joke and became lonely sometimes, surely he was a self. Amazingly, poignantly, he said no. In the epilogue to Skinner's memoirs, we read, quote, "I am sometimes asked, do you think of yourself as you think of the organisms you study? The answer is yes. So far as I know, my behavior at any given moment has been nothing more than the product of my genetic endowment, my personal history, and the current setting. If I am right about human behavior, I have written the autobiography of a non-person," unquote. Sure enough, over the course of 400 pages, the book gives the impression that someone else is telling the story, someone who doesn't care much about him, in fact. His mother's death is related without feeling, and the process of raising his two daughters is described as if it were one of Frederick Taylor's efficiency studies. This uncanny detachment permeated his life. "When I finished Beyond Freedom and Dignity," Skinner once said, "I had a very strange feeling that I hadn't even written the book. It just naturally came out of my behavior, and not because of anything called a me or an I inside." Once the self has been dispatched, it requires only a minor mopping-up operation to finish off the features of being human that we treasure, such as creativity, love, morality, and freedom. Talking, after all, is only verbal behavior, and thinking is only silent talking, so it is not much of a reach to reduce creativity to a series of novel behaviors selected by the environment. Beethoven, Skinner said, or verbally behaved, quote, "was someone who, when he was very young, acquired all the available music at the time, and then, because of things that happened to him personally, as accidents and variations, he introduced new things, which paid off beautifully. So he went on doing them, and he wrote because he was highly reinforced for writing." Unquote. And love? Brace yourself. When two people meet, quote, "one of them is nice to the other, and that predisposes the other to be nice to him, and that makes him even more likely to be nice. It goes back and forth, and it may reach the point at which they are very highly disposed to do nice things to the other and not to hurt. And I suppose that is what would be called being in love." Unquote. Morality, for Skinner and other behaviorists, has been reduced to the question of whether society deems an action appropriate or inappropriate, adaptive or maladaptive. It is never inherently right or wrong. Quote, "To make a value judgment by calling something good or bad is to classify it in terms of its reinforcing effects. The only good things are positive reinforcers, and the only bad things are negative reinforcers. You should, you ought to, tell the truth," we might translate as follows. If you are reinforced by the approval of your fellow men, you will be reinforced when you tell the truth. Philosophers distinguish between this non-moral use of the word good, as in it's good to take out the trash before the bag gets too full, and a moral use, it's good to tell the truth. Skinner eliminated the latter altogether, collapsing it into the former. His view of freedom, meanwhile, is better known, since this is one of the two concepts behaviorism helps us to move beyond, according to the title of his best-selling book published in 1971. Some years ago, Skinner accepted my invitation to give a guest lecture at a class I taught. At the conclusion of his remarks, I couldn't resist a bit of flippant humor. "We certainly want to thank the environmental contingencies responsible for your being here this afternoon," I said. He didn't laugh. Smiling courteously, he replied, "I'm very glad they occurred." Skinner believed that he had chosen to visit my class, and that all of us choose our actions, about as much as a rock in an avalanche chooses where to land. But then the notion that a self freely decides is not likely to make much sense to a man who has repudiated the very idea of a self in the first place. If the rest of us presumptuously persist in talking about intending to do something, it's either because we derive comfort from thinking of ourselves as being in control, or because we are ignorant, individually and collectively, of the forces that actually determine our behavior. Freedom's just another word for something left to learn. It is the way we refer to the ever-diminishing set of phenomena for which science has yet to specify the causes. And now we have the key to understanding the essence of behaviorism. It proceeds from a boundless faith in science, and specifically a narrowly defined version of science that never caught up with modern physics, to tell us everything we need to know. This is described by some philosophers as scientism, by which is meant the assumption that all true knowledge is scientific knowledge. Human beings are to be analyzed in precisely the same way as we would analyze, quote, a chemical compound or the way a plant grows, said Watson. If there are parts of our humanity beyond the grasp of science, so much the worse for those parts. Anything that is not observable, testable, and quantifiable either is not worth our time or does not really exist. Psychologists who talk about consciousness put Watson in mind of, quote, the ancient days of superstition and magic, unquote. If anything, Skinner was even more emphatic in articulating these ideas. The consequence of patterning psychology after the natural sciences is predictable. Psychology's subject matter, us, is reduced to the status of the subject matter of physics and chemistry, things. When we try to explain things, we appeal to causes. When most of us try to account for human behavior, though, we talk about reasons, a conscious decision, rather than an automatic response to some outside force, usually plays a role. But for Skinner, our actions, too, can be completely described in terms of causes. Freedom is just an illusion. Remember, there's no self to be free. What we are is nothing other than what we do. This is the belief that gives behaviorism its name. It is not only academic behaviorists who believe that only measurable behavior is real. A few years ago, a group of businessmen accepted a researcher's offer of a free meal in exchange for their comments on her new psychological questionnaire. One of the men, on his third cigarette before dinner, was scornful of a question that referred to a feeling of trust in the workplace. He said he didn't understand what the word trust meant, apart from its most literal denotation, I trust that you are writing down what I'm saying right now. Later, he spoke up to object to another item, this one asking whether failure is acceptable if a good effort has been made. This, he declared, was a contradiction in terms. All that matters is measurable outcome. And if that is judged a failure, the effort, by definition, was not good enough. In fact, if it can't be quantified, it's not real. This view reflects a thoroughly American sensibility. It is no accident that behaviorism is this country's major contribution to the field of psychology, or that the only philosophical movement native to the United States is pragmatism. We are a nation that prefers acting to thinking and practice to theory. We are suspicious of intellectuals, worshipful of technology, and fixated on the bottom line. We define ourselves by numbers, take-home pay, and cholesterol counts, percentiles, how much does your baby weigh, and standardized test scores, how much does your child know. By contrast, we are uneasy with intangibles and unscientific abstractions such as a sense of well-being or an intrinsic motivation to learn. A thorough criticism of scientism would take us too far afield, but it is important to understand that practice does rest on theory, whether or not that theory has been explicitly identified. The overwhelming majority of teachers, according to one survey, are unable to name or describe a theory of learning that underlies what they do in the classroom. But what they do, what any of us does, is no less informed by theoretical assumptions just because these assumptions are invisible. Behind the practice of presenting a colorful dinosaur sticker to a first grader who stays silent on command is a theory that embodies distinct assumptions about the nature of knowledge, the possibility of choice, and what it means to be a human being. If the premises of behaviorism trouble us once they've been laid bare, perhaps that is an invitation to question the specific practices that rest on those premises. Is it unfair to indict all of behaviorism on the basis of what Watson and Skinner had to say? Yes and no. It is true that they were more extreme than subsequent researchers and therapists on certain issues, such as the status of an inner life. Feelings, attitudes, and intentions were suspect to them, useless for explaining anything people do, completely determined by external factors, largely irrelevant to their version of psychology. In many intellectual movements, the pioneers are unreconstructed and immoderate. It is left to the next generation to temper and qualify and blend.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?